WVW Broadcast Network and The New American are pleased to present The New American TV. This broadcast is dedicated to bringing you the truth behind the news.
Welcome to The New American TV, where we bring you the truth behind the news. Today is Monday, June 26th, and I'm your host, Paul Dragoo. Today we're discussing the anniversary of the death of Roe v. Wade. 1 year ago, the United States Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, removing federal protections for abortion. SCOTUS handed down its decision in Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization on June 24th of last year. This reversed one of the deadliest events of judicial activism in American history. There have been 63 million abortions since Roe, with 1 million abortions each year between 1975 and 2012. But Roe not only made abortion federally protected, but it created the death culture that infects American society today. The Dobbs ruling said that the Constitution does not include a right to abortion, and that the authority to regulate abortion is returned to the people and their elected representatives, to the states. Here's the moment last year when crowds outside the U.S. Supreme Court building in Washington, D.C. heard the news.
The Constitution does not confer a right to abortion!
In the following weeks and months, 24 states passed laws that restrict abortion to some degree. Some pundits claim the SCOTUS decision helped Democrats in the November midterm elections. Oklahoma Republican Senator James Lankford, a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee who was staunchly pro-life, said this on Newsmax.
Yeah, it's pretty remarkable. When you look at what's really a controversial decision, it was the actual Roe v. Wade decision itself 50 years ago when the Supreme Court invented new constitutional authorities. The Dobbs decision, the 24th of June of last year, the Supreme Court came back and looked at it and said, there was no basis for the Roe v. Wade decision. The decision about abortion historically has been a decision that's been made by states and by elected officials, not by judges. And so what the Supreme Court did is they turned it back over to the American people again and said the American people can decide this issue. And so as you mentioned, about half of the states have put in some sort of restrictions on abortion to be able to protect the value of every single child. And some states have actually increased the number of abortions in their state. This is the big national conversation. The best we can tell at this point, we've got about 200,000 children that are alive today that would not have been alive if it wasn't for the Dobbs decision. So there's 200,000 children that'll be headed to kindergarten in a few years that'll be playing out in the playground.
Yeah.
That's a remarkable thing for each of those kids.
Pro-life groups across the nation celebrated on Saturday, commemorating the anniversary. Students for Life of America hosted a national Celebrate Life Day at the Lincoln Memorial in Washington, D.C., where they unveiled a new program called the 14th Amendment for All. The group hopes that unborn children will soon be legally defined as persons with equal protections under the law. Other rallies happened in Chicago, Trenton, New Jersey, and Orange Park, Florida. The Pro-Life Union of Greater Philadelphia held a March for Life, as did the group Pro-Life Wisconsin in Madison. Activists were especially busy in states where America's Holocaust is still enshrined in law. Pro-Life Michigan sponsored a protest outside the Westland abortion facility, while the Progressive Anti-Abortion Uprising held a vigil for victims of abortion outside Planned Parenthood in Washington, D.C. They want everyone to remember that though the Dobbs decision removed federal abortion protections, it's still legal to kill unborn children in 21 states and the District of Columbia. Look at this map from the Family Research Council. The states highlighted in red have legalized abortion until the moment of birth. Many of them already allowed it, but a few states took extra steps after Dobbs. For example, last November, California, Michigan, and Vermont added to their constitutions the so-called right to abortion. In January, Minnesota's governor signed a bill that made abortion a fundamental right. Some states that pass pro-life laws are shackled by liberal judges. For example, last October, an Arizona state appeals court blocked a pre-Roe law protecting unborn life at conception. Similar situations have stymied pro-life bills in places like Utah, Wyoming, Indiana, and the other states you see marked here with stripes. The map indicates the chaos that has resulted from Dobbs a patchwork of pro-life and pro-death states. Ultimately, life is still subject to the whim of the majority or liberal judges, when the opposite should be true. Just as the federal government doesn't have authority to legalize murder, neither should states, localities, and individuals have the right or authority to determine that killing babies in the womb is okay. That's what syndicated columnist and political analyst Judge Andrew Napolitano said about Justice Samuel Alito's majority opinion in Dobbs. Here he is during an interview last September with the New American senior editor Alex Newman.
But what he should have done was to define the baby in the womb as a person. Is the baby in the womb a person? Of course the baby in the womb is a person. The baby has human parents and all of the genomic material within her to develop to all to full postnatal personhood. If the baby in the womb is a person, then all abortion is murder because the 14th Amendment requires the states to protect life, liberty, and property equally. So just as it must protect your life and mine and the lives of the people watching and listening to us now, it would have to protect the lives of the most helpless among us, which are babies in the womb. Instead, by suggesting that somehow, not suggesting, ruling that somehow the states have the authority, either through their legislatures or by popular vote, to take a class of human beings, here babies in the womb, and decide that they don't have the protection of the law. Well, that is reprehensible. I mean, the right to live is a gift from God. It's the most fundamental right there is, and it's not subject to majoritarian impulses. I mean, stated differently, you don't need the approval of the majority of voters in order to live.
Joining me to discuss today's story is the New American senior editor, Rebecca Terrell. Welcome, Rebecca.
Thank you, Paul. Good to see you.
Likewise. So obviously Napolitano is right. They should have established that this is a person, and then maybe we wouldn't be dealing with any of this patchwork of, like we said, dead states, you know, deadly states and pro-life states. This is obviously the next phase of the pro-life battle, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and there are a lot of people who are boots on the ground and still combating all of these pro-death bills. It really shows that the country has a profound lack of any kind of morality. It's not just immoral; it is amoral. We have denied God. God's creation belongs to Him. The earth is the Lord's. And, you know, everybody talks about individual rights and personal rights, reproductive health care rights. What about God's rights here? We belong to God. He gets to make the rules. And yes, I do think that the Supreme Court did shirk its duty. It had an excellent chance to specifically define the unborn person as a person with equal protection under law. And it didn't do it. So even though, you know, I don't want to be just completely a negative Nelly here, there is great reason to be happy about Roe being overturned and about its fallacies being exposed. Because, you know, this age of viability and the trimester system, that basing law on that was something that Roe cooked up out of thin air. There was no precedent.
Right.
So you know, everybody's saying, oh, we've had 50 years of the right to abortion. Well, no, we've had 50 years of this so-called right to murder. No one has a right to offend God.
If you think that's
a right, you don't know what a right is.
Right. No one has a right to kill someone else. That's essentially what this comes down to. And if you establish personhood, then I would think even in today's demented American culture, we can then really, really solidify to protect these guys. Let's get back to our reporting. I'll have you back in a few minutes. So earlier you heard Senator James Lankford of Oklahoma estimating that some 200,000 children are alive today who would otherwise have been aborted. Other groups, however, report lower numbers. According to statistics compiled by the leftist Society of Family Planning, Dobbs saved 24,290 babies from slaughter between July 2022 and March 2023, compared to the pre-Dobbs baseline. There was an estimated 94,000 fewer so-called legal abortions in states that banned the practice, but that number rose by 69,000 over the same period in states that do allow infanticide. If these numbers are accurate, they indicate that a lot of people traveled from pro-life states like Texas, Georgia, Tennessee, and Louisiana, where abortions plummeted. For instance, data show that the number of out-of-state patients doubled in Colorado, which allows abortion up to the moment of birth. Those numbers went from 14% in 2021 to 28% in 2022. As for overall numbers, Planned Parenthood also reports fewer abortions in its recently released annual report, forebodingly titled Relentless. Its clinics butchered 9,300 less babies in 2022 than in 2021. That's a record decrease. However, over the same period, Planned Parenthood net assets increased by $200 million, partly thanks to you, Mr. and Mrs. Taxpayer. Uncle Sam gave the nation's largest abortion provider $670 million of your tax money last year. That's despite Planned Parenthood representatives being caught on tape in 2015 selling aborted baby parts.
So I say, okay, what are you looking to supply today?
A Planned Parenthood doctor discusses getting money for tissue from aborted fetuses.
Secretly recorded, heavily edited videos to make outrageous claims.
Two Orange County medical companies are facing charges of selling fetal tissue illegally.
The tissue is donated from aborted fetuses through Planned Parenthood and other facilities.
Planned Parenthood is now under federal investigation by the Department of Justice for selling fetal body parts.
Critics say that it's unethical to use the material and that taxpayer money should not be used for research that relies on abortion.
Washington Post columnist Michael Gerson has pointed out that charging a fee for this material doesn't...
It's not a fee. It's not a fee. It's actually just the cost of transmitting this material.
But it wasn't just expenses. According to the Center for Medical Progress, which was responsible for that undercover investigation, in December of 2017, two of the bioscience companies involved in the scandal admitted guilt for illegally selling fetal tissues for profit from Planned Parenthood offices in California. They were shut down in a $7.8 million settlement. However, Life News reported that Planned Parenthood raked in as much as $23 million annually from the gruesome practice. And it wasn't until the Trump administration that the federal government canceled its contract with another bioresearch company, Advanced Bioscience Resources, which buys and sells aborted baby parts from Planned Parenthood and other abortion businesses. So, where is all the newly granted taxpayer money going? Abortions are down, and Planned Parenthood recently announced it was cutting staff at its national office. A spokesman for the group said the change didn't reflect money problems. Planned Parenthood was shifting resources from headquarters to its affiliates throughout the country. Melanie Israel of the Heritage Foundation's Daily Signal analyzed the group's annual report, and she may have the answer. Besides prioritizing abortion services, Israel argues that Planned Parenthood's expansion of gender services is likely the primary driver behind the rise in procedures in categories such as other. In 1 year, the category jumped from nearly 16,000 procedures to more than 256,000. So, Rebecca, I guess we shouldn't be surprised that an organization like Planned Parenthood basically opened up a front in another aspect of the mutilation business, huh?
Sure, exactly. Well, I mean, they're still targeting women of childbearing age. You know, if you're restricted on the baby in the womb, then those that you missed, then you can come at them with gender mutilation and all of this gender dysphoria that our young people are plagued with. I think we talked before when we hit on the subject in another show, that before, research shows that before 2012, there were no studies on gender dysphoria in girls. It just simply did not happen. It was not on anybody's radar. And then all of a sudden in 2012, it began to be a thing. Now, prior to that, gender dysphoria in boys was rare, but they found that the majority of boys who had any kind of cross-dressing problems, gender dysphoria, whatever you want to call it, had mothers who had mental problems. And prior to that, any form of homosexuality, say back in the 50s, when they started, I think it was in the 50s, when they first started publishing the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, homosexuality was classified as a mental disorder. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we've come a long way, baby, haven't we?
Yeah, unfortunately, yeah. And that's not the way that we wanted to come along. Thanks, Rebecca. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to continue this report, and we'll have you right back on after the break.
Freedom is the cure.
You're dead on. This is the largest experiment performed on human beings in the history of the world.
The more you know.
What they're doing is they're forcing vaccination on people, and I believe they are killing people with this vaccination.
The freer you are.
It's murder. They are basically murdering people in hospitals.
The all-cause mortality, we know, is now higher in the vaccinated group than the unvaccinated group.
Stay informed on the issues that affect freedom. Get a subscription to The New American today, thenewamerican.com.
Welcome back. So we're continuing our report on the one-year anniversary of the death of Roe. So along with outright funding, the federal government is using other means to promote extremely dangerous chemical abortions. In April, the reputedly pro-life Supreme Court issued an order ensuring that people can still order the abortion drug mifepristone by mail. The pill cuts off nutrients to the baby, who then dies inside the mother's womb. 1 to 2 days later, the woman takes another pill, misoprostol, to induce labor and deliver the dead baby. The experience is painful and involves heavy and prolonged bleeding. It's also extremely risky, as Dr. Christina Francis explained to The New American. She's a board-certified OBGYN and CEO of the American Association of Pro-Life Obstetricians and Gynecologists.
First of all, we know that even with an in-person visit, medication abortions have a 4 times higher complication rate than do surgical abortions. That's even under the best circumstances where they're seen in person, they have an ultrasound, all of that. What's more dangerous now about women obtaining these pills without an in-person visit is we know that the complication rate goes up exponentially the farther along in pregnancy a woman is. And even the American College of OBGYN says that up to 50% of women will be wrong about how far along they are in their pregnancy and need an ultrasound to confirm that. Well, if they're not being seen in person, we don't know how far along they are. Second, they need to be screened for ectopic pregnancies. So one of the common narratives that we're hearing right now is, oh, women are going to die from ectopic pregnancies because abortion is restricted, which of course is false. And I think we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But, you know, all of these abortion proponents are talking about how dangerous ectopic pregnancies are. And they are. It's one of the leading causes of maternal mortality in the first trimester. It occurs in 1 in 50 pregnancies. Well, women who are getting these pills online, they're not being screened for ectopic pregnancy. People giving them these pills have no way of knowing whether or not that pregnancy is in the uterus or not. And if they take these pills, one, the pills don't end an ectopic pregnancy. They're not effective treatment for that. And two, the symptoms of a ruptured ectopic pregnancy are exactly the same as the symptoms of a medication abortion.
She also said that despite claims to the contrary, there are no state laws which prohibit treating life-threatening conditions for miscarriages. Nevertheless, there are women who insist their lives and health are endangered by the death of Roe. Here's one of them testifying before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Capitol Hill in April, claiming that she almost died because she was denied an abortion.
An abortion would have prevented the unnecessary harm and suffering that I endured. Not only the psychological trauma that came with 3 days of waiting, but the physical harm my body suffered, the extent of which is still being determined.
Amanda Zurofsky is suing the state of Texas over this claim. It's a Me Too phenomenon that has cropped up since the Dobbs decision was finalized last June. YouTube marketer Marlena Stell claimed that her doctor denied miscarriage care because of the Texas abortion ban, and CNN lapped the story right up. They didn't bother to ask why Stell didn't report the doctor for medical malpractice, which would protect other women from the same fate. And CNN didn't point out that post-Dobbs abortion bans apply only to elective abortion, not to medical procedures related to miscarriage or other pregnancy complications that require medical intervention. Another detail that they left out is the fact that no abortion clinic is equipped to handle these types of situations. Abortion mills target healthy babies. According to Francis, if someone with emergent complications showed up to an abortion facility, they'd be sent to the nearest ER, where they would receive immediate and life-saving care. As for the real solution to the abortion debate, it's acknowledging that an unborn baby is a person, which would give him equal protection under the law. Who better to summon as an advocate than someone who was born alive after a failed abortion? Here's Deanna Jessen with a powerful testimony about her survival.
I'm adopted, and my biological mother was 17, and so was my biological father. She was 7.5 months pregnant when she decided to go to Planned Parenthood, which is the largest abortion provider in the world, and they counseled her to have a late-term saline abortion, which is a saline salt solution that is injected into the mother's womb. The baby gulps that solution, it burns the baby inside and out, and then she is to deliver a dead baby within 24 hours. And to everyone's great shock and surprise, I didn't arrive dead, but alive. And so I was delivered alive, as I've already said, after 18 hours. I should be blind, I should be burned, I should be dead. And yet I'm not. You know what is fantastic vindication is the fact that the abortionist had to sign my birth certificate. So I know who he is. And it also says, for any skeptic listening, on my medical records, born during saline abortion. Ha! They didn't win.
More than 1,700 babies survive abortions every year, according to the Abortion Survivors Network. But too often, the immediate aftermath is infanticide through strangulation, suffocation, or abandonment. Take the case of Kermit Gosnell, the former Pennsylvania abortionist who is now serving life in prison without parole after a 2013 conviction of first-degree murder in the deaths of three babies born alive. Former staff members testified that was standard procedure for him to use scissors to sever the spinal cords of infants who survived abortions. A grand jury report said that the killings become so routine that no one could put an exact number on them. The problem is so prolific that some states have enacted born-alive laws to ensure that infants receive medical care when they survive attempts on their lives. However, the Family Research Council records only 18 states, which it says have strong and effective born-alive protections. Even if the fact that some children survive abortions is not enough to argue for the personhood of the unborn, consider that when a pregnant woman is killed, her assailant is charged with 2 counts of murder, not one. So, Rebecca, you have mentioned earlier, and I think we can all agree that it looks like this battle, this is a spiritual battle. Perhaps I would think maybe you agree that it's even more than anything. One of the things that has bothered me the most over the years is how weak churches have been on this topic, on this issue. What do you think?
Oh, I absolutely agree. And our bishops in this country and pastors need to step forward. Many are. But I mean, en masse, because if they did, they would exercise such great influence over our laws. You know, another thing I wanted to step back and go back to what Dr. Christina Francis was saying about allowing these medication abortions to be mailed. Mm. You can mail order your chemical abortion. You know, people don't understand how dangerous it is. Other things that she mentioned also in that interview that we didn't have time to air was that you have to have, if a woman has a negative blood type, and that's many of us, I would say it's probably about 50-50 with negative, or maybe even negative is might even be more prolific. You have to have an injection of Rogam or future pregnancies will be at risk. At high risk. You're not getting that when you have a mail order abortion. Another thing that we have a huge problem in this country, bigger even than the drug running from Mexico, is human trafficking. And a lot of these women who are exploited in human trafficking are forced to take these chemical abortions. This is not empowering women like the left is so prone to say, oh, we want to empower women. No, this is enslaving women. And allowing these abortion on demand just by mail order pharmacy it's heinous. And absolutely, there, you know, we look down our noses at old stories of the Aztecs or the Incas or whoever in child sacrifice, who would sacrifice children to the gods.
Yeah.
What are we doing?
Yeah, this is exactly the different. Same thing. Yeah. Let's finish our report here. Now we'll have you right back on in the tail end there. So this past year has also been witness to an unprecedented and, for the most part, still unsolved string of attacks on pro-life pregnancy centers across the nation. Pregnancy resource centers offer healthcare and support services to women who find themselves facing unplanned pregnancies. They help mothers who want to keep their babies, including support after birth, by helping them get on their feet. They also make adoption routes available. The attacks on these nonprofits began even before SCOTUS finalized Dobbs, about the time that someone leaked the decision earlier last year. Curiously, that's another case that remains unsolved. In March, Utah's Republican Senator Mike Lee grilled U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland when the latter testified before the Senate Judiciary Committee. He pointed out the disparity between the FBI's prosecution of abortion clinic protesters and pregnancy help center firebombers. Let's watch.
DOJ has announced charges against 34 individuals for blocking access to or vandalizing abortion clinics. And there have been over 81 reported attacks on pregnancy centers, 130 attacks on Catholic churches since the leak of the Dobbs decision, and only 2 individuals have been charged. So how do you explain this disparity?
These people who are doing this are clever and are doing it in secret. And I'm convinced that the FBI is trying to find them with urgency.
Many blame the agency's inaction on politicization of the FBI against pro-lifers. Here's what Jim Harden, president and CEO of Compass Care Pregnancy Services in New York, witnessed after the leaked Dobbs decision.
And after that, there was this cascading kind of press PR campaign against pregnancy centers and all that war. The Biden administration came out on Friday, basically charging the Attorney General Merrick Garland to investigate the quote unquote fraudulent practices of pregnancy centers. You have the Attorney General Letitia James in New York coming out, signing a letter to Google demanding that they wipe us off the maps. We've got 21 senators and congressmen sending another letter to Google saying that we shouldn't be able to advertise on Google. This is an all-out war on pregnancy centers.
In January, the U.S. House passed Concurrent Resolution 3, expressing the sense of Congress condemning the recent attacks on pro-life facilities, groups, and churches. The resolution is awaiting action in the Senate Judiciary Committee. Stay tuned, folks, because when we come back, Rebecca will be talking to one of the hardest fighting pro-life activists in the nation. We'll be right back with Rebecca's interview.
In 1988, the John Birch Society produced a documentary so predictive, it's as though they had a time machine. Out of Control, Immigration Invasion was produced and hosted by investigative reporter William F. Jasper and looks at the growing problem of unrestricted illegal immigration that, in 1988, already saw upwards of 10 to 20 million illegal aliens within the borders of the U.S. Unknown agents from around the world using the southern border as easy entry. Certainly, some are innocent families escaping hardship, but also certainly some are criminals, potentially terrorists. Is it not appropriate that there be some criteria for the entry of any sovereign nation? Why should the U.S. be different than Canada, Germany, Russia, Japan, or every other country on the planet? Out of Control, Immigration Invasion. Watch this time capsule of prescient wisdom at thenewamerican.com/out of control.
Welcome back to The New American TV, and I'm your host for this segment, Senior Editor Rebecca Terrell, and I'm sitting here with Randall Terry. Anyone who is familiar with the pro-life movement knows your name and your face.
Thank you, Rebecca.
And loves your name.
They
and
don't
your
see
face.
My face right now. This
That's
is crazy.
Right. What's with your new look here?
It's not forever. I am in a movie this summer. I actually am going to play the role of a drug lord, a Mexican drug lord. Hablo español.
You look very
good. Voy a matarte y su familia y su perro. So
that's
I
always say.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Said I'm gonna kill you and your dog.
Oh.
So I'm gonna. The dog especially. She gets on my nerves. So I'm gonna dye it all black and trim it up and look like a bad guy, and then I can go back to looking normal.
Well, that's a way to celebrate the 1-year anniversary of Dobbs, isn't it? What? So give me your thought. I know you were there on at the Supreme Court when the decision came down, and I thought it was just so touching, your reaction. It was describe it. Because
I was crying my eyes out because I've been fighting my whole adult life to end the killing of children. So it was a day, it was taking Normandy Beach.
Right.
It was not a victory that ended the war. It was a victory that made it so we could get to Berlin, to use a World War II analogy.
Very good analogy.
So I'm, as the year has passed, that's where our real problems are and the battles and some victories. But you want to talk about the last year?
Well, yeah, I want to talk about the last year. I also want to I want to get your thoughts on Judge Andrew Napolitano, who was in the first part of our program, talked about how the Supreme Court really reneged on a duty they had and an opportunity they had to declare unborn children as people, as personhood, give them personhood under the law with equal protection for the law. So in that respect, Dobbs was a missed opportunity, even though it's certainly good news that Roe was overturned.
Of course. No, I completely agree. That was their constitutional duty. It was their moral duty before God.
Right.
I want to kind of back into it.
Okay.
My fear for the country right now is that we are crying for the judgment of God. Before Roe was overturned, we could say, hey, we can't do anything. We're fighting at the state level. The Supreme Court has ruled, and it's tyrannical, and it's judicial tyranny. But now they're saying in states like Michigan, we want to kill our children.
Right.
So you've got women who are Christians, people who have a Trinitarian baptism, men who have a Trinitarian baptism, that are saying we want to kill our children. Mm-hmm. 75% of the country has some form of Christianity, and yet 60 to 70%, depending on the poll, say that they think overturning Roe is a bad thing.
Wow.
So there's a huge crossover in there of people who say that they are Christians, say that they love God, say that they pray, or they maybe they go to church, who want to be able to kill their children.
Right.
This is so reprehensible. And for me, it's like God, it's like Romans chapter 1 in the scriptures, which says God handed them over.
Yeah.
So for me to watch this post-Roe era and to see people clamoring for the right to kill their offspring, now I'm scared. And I think that as you look at the country over the last couple of years and this whole trans, woke, evil, this all this demonic stuff happening, we're spiraling down at a rate that is, in my opinion, is accelerated.
Right.
We're looking worse, faster.
Right.
And I think it's God's judgment.
I do too. I agree completely. And I do want to interrupt us for just a moment, though, because I want to call attention to the fact that a lot of our viewers may have experience with abortion. And I don't.
Lord have mercy.
But no,
there's people that are grieving, people that participated in the death of a child, whether their own child or they took a friend and for those people, we know that there is redemption. For all of us, there's redemption. All of us have committed sins.
Right.
All of us have done things that procure the judgment of God.
Right. And no one, I mean, some people's vices are more public than others. For those that are, suffering.
I'm just saying right now to your viewers. I mean, every time I see her, the makeup is perfect. All right, go ahead. Back to you.
Well, but seriously, though, we do have to be very, very sensitive to the fact that there are many, many women who are victims of abortion themselves. They were told that this is the right thing to do. This is the right way out. There's no problem with this. And now after they have the abortion, they realize what a horrible mistake they did. There is forgiveness. And, you know, there's a whole group called the Abortion Survivors Network of children grown. Now they're adults, but when they were babies, they were attempted abortions on them.
They survived the abortion.
And they survived the abortions, just like Gianna Jessen and so many others, Melissa Ogden. And all of them, to a person, have said they forgive their birth mother. outright. They absolutely forgive their birth mother. They love their birth mother. They appreciate the chance for
life.
That
is so awesome.
And it is so profound. So there's healing. There is forgiveness. There's forgiveness here as well as
forgiveness in the next life.
Right.
I thank you for bringing that up. And I want to say clearly to anyone who has participated in the death of their child or someone else's child, this is not about condemning you or anyone else.
Right.
This is a discussion about public policy so that we make it a crime to kill an innocent human being from conception until birth.
Right.
That's the mission of the pro-life movement. It's a very finite mission. It's not about capital punishment. It's not about war. It's not about manslaughter and what constitutes an accident. It's not about drug overdoses. The purpose of the pro-life movement is one thing: make it a crime to kill a baby from conception until birth.
Right.
That's it.
Right.
So part of the issue is us owning it.
So.
Oh, I'm sorry. Part of it is us owning it. There's a lot of people in the pro-life movement that are trying to play cutesy right now.
Right.
They don't want to say that abortion is murder. They don't want to show pictures of the babies.
Mm-hmm.
They want to say, we want a place at the table. We want a discussion. We want this to, we don't want unfettered abortion. We don't want abortion till the day of birth. They're trying to soft sell it.
Right.
As opposed to saying exactly what we believe.
Right.
Abortion is murder. It does not matter if you're one cell or two or four or eight or 16 or if you're 10 weeks and it's a suction abortion or 24 weeks and it's a saline abortion. It doesn't matter. This is an innocent human being, and we have an obligation before God to say the truth and to act on the truth.
Right.
That's the mission.
And, you know, something touching on that I learned in nursing school, that I thought this is the one thing that will solve any argument about when the clump of cells becomes a person. The moment that sperm and egg unite in a mother, immediately there is a protective protein layer formed around that brand new baby. Because
it's an individual human being.
If that fails, then the mother's immune system recognizes it as a foreign individual and tries to rid her body of it. As if it's a cancer. Now, once it implants in the womb, there are even more things that the body automatically does to shut down the mother's immune system, to keep her immune system from attacking that baby, because otherwise it would identify. You know, when people have a kidney transplant or a heart transplant, they have to, the rest of their lives, they have to
insist
on immune suppressing medicines.
I could, I know that you have thousands of viewers, and I would like to challenge them, if I may.
Yes, please do.
The problem that we have had in the pro-life movement is that most of us value our reputation and our peace and comfort and lack of conflict more than we value justice and the lives of the innocent. So there are people that are listening to us right now, and they believe that abortion is wrong. They might even believe that abortion is murder.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is going to hurt some people's feelings, but if you could just bear with me for 2 minutes. If all of us were put on trial right now, every single person was brought in before some tyrannical court, and we were going to be tried as to whether or not we had attempted to take away a woman's constitutional right to terminate her pregnancy. You are on trial to see if there's evidence that you tried to take away this sacred right.
Mm.
Like you're on trial for trying to reinstitute slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Do we have any evidence, hard evidence, that this individual and that individual and this individual and that individual conspired together to try and make it a crime for a woman to kill her child? Most Christians would be not guilty.
Oh, that's a very good point.
They would not have any evidence. Well, I was in the street and there was pictures of me in the press and I was holding up a sign that said abortion is murder. Oh, yep, you're guilty. I wrote a letter to the editor. I started a quarrel at the Thanksgiving dinner, and my family will testify against me. So I want to be found guilty.
Right.
I want to be found guilty of trying to end a woman's right to kill her baby. There is no right to kill her baby. But the tragedy is most Christians of every denomination do not have evidence that they tried to stop the killing.
Right.
So if that's you, there's all kinds of ways that you can be in this fight and and get a target put on your back.
Well, I think you'd be found guilty because Operation Rescue. When did you found Operation Rescue? That was the '80s.
Yes, it was. It was 1986.
Okay, 86, and you led it until the '90s.
Yeah, well, the federal government broke our back under Bill Clinton with the passage of the FACE Act,
right.
Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances. So I was the leader of a group called Operation Rescue, but I was also the leader of the movement called the Rescue Movement. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it's 30 years ago now.
Right. So what did you do? Tell us what you would do.
We led the largest peaceful civil disobedience movement in American history.
And you're making a documentary about that right
yes,
now.
Yes, we are. Yes, called Dragon Slayers, How Operation Rescue Slew Roe. So part of why I'm being so intense with people is that there are certain ways that American laws are changed. Mm-hmm. And it's not just at the legislative level.
Sure.
Long before you get to the legislative level, there has to be social tension. There has to be incendiary images. There has to be radical rhetoric. Mm-hmm. There has to be sacrifice. There has to be all these things that take place. And if they don't take place, you will never get a legislative end.
Right.
So right now, the momentum is with our adversaries.
Sure.
They're taking to the street. They're having marches. They're doing all these things. And pro-lifers are sitting back going, oh, we overturned Roe. Isn't this great? I mean, yeah, it's great. It's a first step, but it's not the end.
Right.
We've got to employ the rules and the weaponry of social change mm-hmm. that are laid out before us in history with the abolitionists and women's voting rights, all these things. Mm-hmm. So this is not a mystery how we win, but it will cost us. So this last year for me in the post-Dobbs world has been very demoralizing. Very demoralizing because the momentum is with them. It is not with us.
Right.
We have blown an opportunity to just rise to the occasion and say abortion is murder and we will not stop until it is a crime in all 50 states.
Right. And we know that. We know because the SCOTUS has made it possible for the mail order chemical abortions.
All right, so here, listen, this is, let me get to the, right. I know we've only got a minute
left. Yeah, we've got a minute.
Are you prepared to say, am I prepared to say, we will prosecute a woman who has RU-486 in her possession?
Good
that's
point.
The end of the, that's the end of the matter. It must be a criminal act. And if a woman is ordering these drugs, she has to be prosecuted for a crime.
Mm-hmm.
And most pro-lifers are afraid to say that. They're right. afraid to own it. And then we'll never win.
Right.
If we won't make it a criminal act to possess and distribute that particular drug,
yep.
then we will never win.
Yep.
So we have to own it. Hey, well, you're going to put a woman in jail for 20 years?
Yep.
No, maybe we'll put her in jail for 20 minutes.
Right.
Maybe it's a $20 fine.
Right.
But if we won't make it a criminal act so that a woman has to be fingerprinted and her picture taken,
right.
then we're never going to win.
You're right. And I want to leave with one final thought, a biblical citation for what you're talking about, that St. John the Baptist leapt in his mother's womb when he heard the voice of the precursor of our Lord, who was his own mother, because his Lord had come to him. And he did that while he was in the womb. So a baby is a person's a person, no matter how small. So we will leave with that. Randall, thank you so much.
Rebecca, and thank you for having me.
Well, it's great. Always
go to randallterry.com if you want to learn more. Randallterry.com.
And
you could also see the trailer that we've made for our documentary on Operation Rescue.
Absolutely. Thank you, Randall.
Thank you.
As a lumberjack, I've been cutting wood for decades. My job is pretty straightforward. I see the wood, I chop the wood. My axe goes through every time. You remember when everyone bought all the toilet paper? And they wanted me to wear these things? And someone invested a lot of money into this stuff. They say I'm part of a global plan. I don't think so. It's too hot, it's too cold. You know what? The weather changes. We even hear crazy ideas on how kids should learn.
Here's the news, Dad.
Is it, son? Is it?
What about this one, Dad?
Nope. It's hard to tell what's real and what's fake these days. There's just too much baloney out there. At the New American, they cut through the baloney and give me the truth.
Visit thenewamerican.com and subscribe to get 50% off the cover price. And if you want an even better deal, use the promo code 10 off sub.
Again, that's 10 off sub for more than 50% off.
To complete today's program, Steve Bonta and Gary Benoit discuss another basic principle. Today's principle, there are two forms of popular government, republics and democracies. Watch.
Hello, everybody. This is Gary Benoit, and today I'm with Steve Bonta, the executive senior editor for the New American Magazine, for another episode of Principles. Steve, it's good to have you here.
Good to be here, Gary. Hi.
Hi. Now, today we want to talk about mobocracy and specifically how democracies are inherently unstable and how they do have this tendency to move toward mobocracy and eventually totalitarianism.
Okay, well, first of all, I mean, this term democracy, for some of our readers who may not be too familiar with this, is a term that gets bandied about an awful lot today. Mm-hmm. And so pretty much any country that has a popular form of government is called a democracy, including the United States. We are a democracy. And in point of fact, it's probably not incorrect to say that we have democratic elements, in particularly at the local level, you know, the New England town hall, for example. We elect some of our leaders democratically by a vote. That term kind of applies there. But to characterize the government as a whole, particularly the federal government framed by the Constitution as a democracy, is flat out incorrect. So the question is, what is a democracy in reality? Well, a democracy is a government that tends toward the ideal of direct rule of the people themselves without any kind of intermediary filters such as representation, and certainly without any constraints such as law that can't be violated even by the majority.
And of course, also the separation of powers.
Well, sure, the separation, all this stuff. So all of those things that we have there's really no other term for it, brainwashed into believing are features of our so-called democracy are in fact, features of the other type of popular government that we discussed previously, which is republics. And there are different types of republics, to be sure. And we'll talk about that
further
on. But to kind of zoom in on democracy in particular, I mean, this idea goes back, well, it goes back a long time. I mean, there have been people always who have argued that, well, since the law and the authority of government proceeds ultimately from the people themselves, that there shouldn't be any intermediary agency. The people should, in effect, govern themselves. And this is what the ancient Greeks in Athens attempted to do, although we often refer to it as the Athenian Republic, because it did have some semblance of structure and law, but it was much closer to a pure and, you know, direct democracy.
But basically, whatever the majority says goes.
Pretty much, yes. And in the Athenian Republic, every citizen, every male citizen was expected to actually participate in legislation. Mm-hmm. Okay? They didn't just vote. They actually participated. So there were, you know, 6,000, 7,000, 8,000 such individuals in the city of Athens, and they were all expected to participate. So it was an attempt to include everyone in the actual task of governance.
Right.
So that's what democracy is.
But of course, now, the majority can oftentimes be wrong. And Steve, I'd just like to share a quote that I found getting ready for today's presentation. And this is from the movie The Patriot, which I'm sure you've seen. It starred Mel Gibson.
I've not only seen it, I wrote the New American Review for it many years ago.
That's right. I had forgotten about that. So thank you for reminding me. And Mel played the central character, Benjamin Martin, and here's a statement from the movie. He said, "Why should I trade one tyrant 3,000 miles away for 3,000 tyrants 1 mile away?" What do you think of his point?
Well, it was a very perceptive point, and people tend to think today, people who haven't thought about this very deeply or pretty much allow themselves to be persuaded by whatever they're told by mostly liberal talking heads on television, that the only goal of government is that the people have a voice. That's the only thing. You know, if you have that, then you've got good government, end of story. But there's another really important dimension. Okay, well, you know, I mean, besides the idea that the people should be free, and that is that government should be stable, that it should last. I mean, what good is setting up a wonderful free society if it only lasts 20 years? Or 50 years, or something like that. So, you know, the aforementioned Athenian Republic, which was in fact closer to being what we would call a democracy, did not last very long. It was quickly overwhelmed first by people from within who subverted the system, including Pericles. You know, he was one of those people that did that. And then thusly weakened, it was conquered first by the Spartans and then by other powers, culminating, of course, in Macedon and became part of the Greek mm-hmm. Empire, the Hellenistic period. So it was a flash in the pan. It was brilliant while it lasted, but it was very unstable. So, you know, the Romans wanted to create something more stable. They did. Certain subsequent European republics, the Venetian Republic in particular, lasted for a very long time. The Florentine Republic did not. The Italians love republics, and there have been many of them that have sprung up and died in the Italian peninsula over the millennia since Rome. But the founders of the United States said, you know, we want to have something that is not just going to protect liberty, but that's going to last. And this was one of the things that led to the Constitutional Convention. The Articles of Confederation, America's first constitution, were a wonderful document and well-suited to the times in which they were created, which was a wartime. It was a time of crisis. They worked. But after America became independent, won its independence, it became clear that the Articles of Confederation were insufficient protectors of stability. Now, as far as democracy is concerned, fortunately for us, unfortunately for the French, we have a wonderful example from almost the same period as the American founding, the French Revolution.
French Revolution.
Probably the purest attempt to create right. democracy that in the annals of history.
A lot of people like to compare the two.
Sure, a lot
like
of people
compare the French Revolution with the American Revolution, but in reality, there's more contrast than there is comparison.
Yeah, they're not. And I mean, they come from different philosophical wellsprings, mm-hmm. as people have observed. And people say, well, what's the difference between, say, the French Enlightenment of Diderot and Voltaire and that crowd mm-hmm. who ultimately gave rise to the ideals of the French Revolution versus, you know, the Lockes and the Montesquieus and so forth, whose ideas led to the founding of the American Republic. And it was this. In the British or English, you know, English and Scottish primarily strains of thought, there was always this notion that freedom, however desirable, is not absolute, that there are limits. And whereas in Europe, on the continent, in France in particular, there was always this idea that there should be absolutely impartial and amoral egalitarianism, such that, for example, a devout believer should be treated exactly the same as an atheist, and more to the point, not just in terms of the law, but that their ideas should be given equal credence in the mm-hmm. public forum. And that was never the case with the English and the Scottish. There was this idea that, well, yeah, you know, in theory, if you want to believe or practice certain things that are pernicious to the public weal, you can do that. But we're not going to accept those ideas and give them equal footing with ideas that clearly are of more merit. And the French, you know, had this more almost nihilistic approach, and that led to this French Revolution, where the expression they had was vox populi, vox Dei, which is actually Latin. It means the voice of the people is the voice of God. And that is manifestly
on the same level as God.
Exactly. And that is manifestly mm-hmm. not true. But that could mm-hmm. be said to be the central creed of democracy, that whatever the people says, and by people we mean the majority of the people, should be treated as though it were the voice of God right. at any given time, and therefore is the ultimate arbiter over what is right and what is wrong. That's democracy in a nutshell.
Sure. And of course, it always erodes until eventually becomes tyranny. But on the way to tyranny, you have mobocracy.
Well, yes, and see, this is the problem, of course, is that in addition to being wrong from a moral mm-hmm. and theological point of view, it doesn't make sense from a practical point of view either. And this is what the founders, in particular Madison, perceived and articulated so well in Federalist 10 mm-hmm. and other sources,
sure.
where they said, you know, the fundamental problem with democracy is that it is so unstable and inevitably gives rise to tyranny. And that is, of course, precisely what happened in France. The ideals, if you can call that of the Gironde, the Girondists and the Montagnards and all that, mm-hmm. those different factions that wanted this pure democracy, gave way first to the Terror under Robespierre, mm-hmm. under which circumstances it was still considered to be, it was basically a mobocracy. And then, of course, that couldn't be sustained for too long. So along comes Napoleon and fixes the problem. And the French and the rest of the European continent, into the bargain, suffered mightily under Napoleon for the next 20 years. We of course, benefited because we ended up getting the Louisiana Territory. But, but you know, other than that, I mean, the French Revolution led to what was then an unexampled calamity in European history.
Right. I have a copy here, Steve, of the Federalist Papers. And I'd just like to read from Federalist number 10. Which you referred to, that of course was written by James Madison. And this is what he said about democracies. Democracies have ever been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have ever been found incompatible with personal security or the rights of property, and have in general been as short in their lives as they have been violent in their deaths.
He knew what he was talking about.
Sure did. Okay, well, thank you, Steve. We got to wrap up now, but... In the next episode of Principles, we'll be focusing on a republic.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of The New American TV. And remember to visit thenewamerican.com for more truth behind the news. And if you haven't already, get a subscription to our biweekly print magazine, where you can read more content you won't find anywhere else. See you tomorrow.
Life. Liberty. And the pursuit of happiness. The Declaration of Independence proclaims God-given rights, and we intend to protect them. Working with people like you for over 50 years, preserving freedom and building a better tomorrow. Safeguarding the Constitution by limiting government power. We are restoring liberties, educating voters, and leading the freedom movement. Join with us. United, we will defend our rights. We are all Americans. We are the John Birch Society.